I need you here on my mind every hour of the day. Without your sweet inspiration,
everybody. It's Tuesday night. It's 7 p.m. on the Left Coast. And, of course, it's time for the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. This is Tammy Jackson. As I tell you every week, I'm welcoming you to an hour of sweet conservative inspiration. If you'd like to do so, go ahead and interact with comments and questions on Twitter during the show. You can follow me at Tammy J. That's T-A-M-I-J. My first guest tonight is Jack Carr. I'm telling you right now, you need to write that name down because you're going to be hearing it a lot in the future. Jack Carr is a former Navy SEAL. Let me run down the quick bio. Jack Carr is a former Navy SEAL who led special operations teams on four continents as team leader, platoon commander, troop commander, and task unit commander. Over his 20 years in Navy Special Warfare, he transitioned from an enlisted SEAL sniper specializing in communications and intel to a junior officer leading assault and sniper teams in Iraq and Afghanistan, to a platoon commander practicing counterinsurgency in the southern Philippines, to commanding a special ops task unit in the most Iranian-influenced section of southern Iraq throughout the tumultuous drawdown of U.S. forces. Jack retired from active duty in 2016. You can find more of Jack's impressive froggy bio on the show page. Jack Carr, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm pretty darn excited. I'll tell you, the publicist that I deal with, David, over there at Simon and Schuster's division, where you're part of there, he contacted me before Christmas and said, Tammy, this is still your address to send books to, right? And, well, he should know. I get sent books all the time. I'm on the Simon and Schuster list. And he said, I've got somebody. I'm not even going to tell you much about him, except he's a SEAL or was a Navy SEAL. And he goes, but that's really all I'm going to say. I want you to read it and tell me exactly what you think, and I can't wait to hear. And so I got this book almost overnighted to me. And I thought, well, okay, cool. This is a book for Christmas, I guess, for me. And I just started thumbing through it. And before I knew it, I was sucked into it and couldn't put it down. So,
thank you so much.
Yeah. And I'm so glad I could have you on before it debuts. Everybody listening, this novel, The Terminal List, comes out next Tuesday. Yep. Next Tuesday, March 6th. So I get him the week before it comes out. So you guys have plenty of times to pre-order it on Amazon. I've got it all set up for easy ordering. You can click on the title or the book picture. Get over there. I'm telling you, pre-order one for yourself. Stock up on gifts for any and all family and friends who love special ops action thrillers. Jack, I was acquainted with Vince Flynn, read every one of his books. And I'm telling you, Vince would be high-fiving you right now.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. Actually, I met him years and years ago at SHOT Show in Vegas, which is the industry show that deals with firearms and gear and all that sort of thing.
Know it well.
Yeah, it's a great show. And also, it's almost like a reunion when I go there these days. So it's a lot of fun. And over the years, I went there to make sure that my guys, he was out there on the private side, in the private sector, and make sure my guys were going down range with the best gear and equipment that we could possibly find. I got to have the honor of meeting Vince there, and it was right at the end of the show. So as you know, when that show ends, everybody starts flooding out to those hallways, and we just stayed behind in the show until they kicked us out, and we got to have a nice long conversation. And he was so great, so kind to me. Couldn't have been more generous with his time, and just an amazing guy.
He really was. And I think everybody that met Vince, you got a sense of it a little bit as you read his books, and you thought, I think I'd like this guy. It just came through his words somehow. And then when you actually meet him in person, I found the same thing from the very first. He was just absolutely gracious, nice, very, very funny. I'll never forget He was doing a book talk the first time I met him, and I talked to him on air on another talk show that I was on, and he was a guest on the show also. But when we met in person, he'd been talking to everybody, and somebody asked something about enhanced interrogation, and he laughed. He says, "You wonder if it works? You ask my mom. She raised, and I can't remember if it was five or six boys. She said, you ask her, she'll tell you, yes, enhanced interrogations work."
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I don't think I'd be as quite as witty as that, but yeah, he was so great. We had a great great conversation, and I didn't tell him at the time that I wanted to be an author, because I still had, I think I must have met him in maybe 2009, maybe, but you know, I still had quite a few years left in the SEAL teams, and when you're taking guys downrange and you're responsible for them, I mean, you owe it to them, to their families, to the mission, to the country, to really be solely focused on that job and on that mission. So yes. I knew I wanted to be a writer in the future, but at that point in time, it was all about the guys and all about taking them downrange and being as effective as we could possibly be. But so I didn't tell him I wanted to be an author, but we got to talk, and I remember I asked him, do you ever wake up and think that somebody read the term limits and is going to start doing some of those things that you wrote about in there? Somebody with a background similar to the guys that you wrote about in that book, which happens to be similar to my background as well. And he said he wakes up every single day and thinks about that. Always,
wow.
Always tell me that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. And so people listening, we're talking to Jack Carr about his book that's coming out next Tuesday, The Terminalist. It's fabulous. Absolutely fabulous. All of my listeners, I would say most of them, I know a lot of them personally, and others I've heard from around the world. And most of them, like me, love this genre. We're mostly patriots, Second Amendment people. We support the military, our special forces, et cetera. Love them to death. And so these kind of books are just right in our bailiwick. If you're listening, Brad Thor. And this is pretty cool because everybody knows Brad Thor, but he writes of your freshman outing in the author world, quote, "absolutely awesome, so powerful, so pulse-pounding, so well-written. Rarely do you read a debut novel this damn good," end quote. And then Chuck Norris writes of The Terminalist, "an extremely unique thriller, absolutely intense." Now, Jack Carr, what I thought of when I first started reading it, I chuckled, and it took me back to some old movies, and I'm thinking maybe you've seen them, although they'd be before your time, but Chuck Bronson's Death Wish movie series. They're a great...
Bruce Willis. A new one's coming out with Bruce Willis here in March.
Yes, yes, exactly. But I loved it because it was the same sort of thing. If people took the Death Wish movie series and did them by a Navy SEAL with better technology and weapons, you'd kind of get an idea of The Terminalist. So it's absolute literary candy for someone like me who loves this genre. As I told you, my main publicist contact at Atria Mystery Books, he warned me about you. He said, "You're going to love this, I think." And he knows me well enough. But when I got back to him and said I loved it, he was like, "I knew it. I just knew it." So let's get the listeners to know you a little bit more, Jack.
But real quick, before we move on to that, you mentioned the Death Wish movies. And, you know, as a kid, I always loved reading books in this genre as well. And the ones that really resonated with me were books that were about revenge. And same thing with movies. Like, there's just something very primal about that topic. So it always fascinated me. And that's why I wanted to come out of the gate strong with a very, very primal book that was about revenge without constraint. But with someone that had the skills, real world and the training to really do the job, and also to take some of the lessons that he learned overseas that the enemy had been very successful with against us, and take those home to this country as he works his way up the list. So that that revenge theme, I think, really resonates with people, and it did with me growing up. So that's why the first book is about that theme.
Yeah. Oh, it's tremendous. It really is. As the listeners get to know you a little bit, you say you wanted to be a Navy SEAL beginning in the second grade. How in the world did that come about?
Yeah. So 7 years old. And since I was a little kid, I always wanted to serve my country. and I just didn't know exactly what it was going to be. My grandfather was in World War II. He was killed off Okinawa in 1945. He was a Corsair pilot, which is that plane that has the gull-shaped wings.
Yes.
And the two kamikazes hit the Bunker Hill on May 11th, 1945, and he was in the ready room at the time, and the first kamikaze was pretty much a direct hit on that ready room. So I grew up with my grandfather's medals and those silk maps that they used to give guys so that they hit the water, they wouldn't disintegrate like paper would. Old black and white photos of his squadron, his wings, that sort of thing. So I grew up with this appreciation of the military and love of country. So I knew I was going to go into the military and do something. And then I remember watching a movie in second grade with my dad, and it was called The Frogmen, and an old black and white film. And it showed guys swimming up over the beach and planting explosives on obstacles. And I asked my dad who those guys were, and he said, "Ask your mother." And my mom was a librarian at the time, so we got to go to the library and do a little research into frogmen and seals and find out a little more about them. And they had me from the second grade on, so it was I was focused on that through junior high, high school, college, and then came in right after college.
Wow. Now, I learned quite a bit about Navy SEALs from reading Marcus Luttrell's Lone Survivor. And I got to tell you, and that's not a novel. I think a lot of my listeners will have read that because that's kind of like the Bible of early SEAL literature. And but reading that, I can remember being on my stationary bike because I always did a workout really early in the morning, before in the morning, and I'd be writing for like an hour reading that book. And there were times when I was crying as things were happening to them, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, the rules of engagement, the ROE that these people in D.C. put forth that are endangering our operators. I was livid. I was heartbroken. I just couldn't believe it. So that really opened my eyes not only to BUDS, to SEAL training, et cetera, and what SEALs actually went through, but also the positively horrible, horrible stuff that comes out of Washington, D.C. that dictates what our warriors can and cannot do, as opposed to giving them the tools, have them take out the bad guys and get home alive. And I just... I had that in my craw. And so anybody that reads your book will get a real charge out of the fact that the protagonist in the book, James Reese, definitely points out some abysmal failures. And he takes out some failures, quite a few of them. And so there's something just very satisfying about that. It's not just the revenge. It's that, oh my goodness, Jack Carr, we live in this era right now where millions of patriots across this nation are being made fun of because we believe in the Second Amendment, we believe in our military and our nation, etc. And then there are some rarefied people in D.C., in politics, etc., that are responsible for things like Benghazi, and none of them ever get what's coming to them.
Well, they do in this book. They certainly do, and it was very therapeutic to write, you could say, in that respect.
I would think so. I wanted to ask you, do you stay in touch with the SEAL community? People listening, if you don't know the SEAL community that well, it's still pretty small, actually. I mean, a couple 3,000, something like that?
Yeah, about 2,500 active duty SEALs, and there's, I don't know exactly how many of that number are actually the guys kicking indoors, because there's quite a few of that number that are in staff positions, you know, that aren't doing the job that they came in to do. So when you say 2,500, it's really even smaller than that if you're thinking about it in the tactical sense of the guys on the ground actually doing the mission. So it's a pretty small slice of the overall military.
And do you stay in touch with them?
Oh yeah. Yeah. A great friend. I mean, you create some amazing friendships, in my case over 20 years, but no matter how long you stay in, and, it's a brotherhood.
Absolutely. I did a Veterans Day special. I've probably done a couple of those. And on this one particular one, I had some good friends. Ryan Zinke came on, and, my good friend, Lieutenant Colonel USMC retired Freddie Blish, but everybody that I had on, and then my friend Chris Synog, who was a SEAL sniper that developed the sniper program and trained a lot of the snipers. But I asked each of them, what do you miss most? And they said, the guys. I miss that camaraderie of being in the units, the operational units, with the guys. They all said that to a man. And I understand the close-knit brotherhood that forms when you guys are downrange, for sure.
Right, right. That's a fairly typical answer, is that that you miss the people. Especially in a close-knit community where there's the life and death consequences to your decisions, and it's quite close.
Well, the protagonist in The Terminal List, as I've said, is a Navy SEAL. Makes perfect sense. And Jack Carr, your book, The Terminal List, made the featured review at The Real Book Spy. Yeah. Great review. People can read it there. The review begins. A potential new star of the genre emerges in Jack Carr's debut thriller, which introduces a lethal protagonist in the same vein as other iconic literary heroes, such as Mitch Rapp and Scott Harvath. While carrying out a high-stakes mission near the Khost province in Afghanistan, Navy SEAL Commander James Reese and his men inadvertently walk straight into an ambush, and only Reese survives. That's how it starts out. And I want to set this book up. I'm not going to tell people everything that happens, but they got to know enough to really whet their appetite, Jack. And sure. So this guy, James Reese, the Navy SEAL commander, he's lost his team, and this happens really early in the book that we're hearing about him losing this team. It's an ambush, an absolute ambush, and they say that the whole thing from the beginning did not smell right. It was something that it came down from up high, as opposed to the other way around, from the intel that the unit on the ground had found. So everything is not right with it. And then things go south from there. Not only does he lose his unit, he comes home and there's a whole lot of loss stateside.
Absolutely. It's I wanted to go back to that the Japanese tradition of Bushido. So I studied that as a kid growing up and in high school and college, as I was preparing myself, since I had a long time. It's maybe what I wanted to do for so long. I had a long time to prepare for it. Right. But essentially, the samurai would go into battle believing they were already dead, and they believed that made them more effective warriors. So in death, they weren't afraid of dying in battle. So I figured, hey, how do you take that Bushido tradition and apply that to this story of revenge without constraint? And I said, well, you have to have a guy that really believed that he was already dead, and that's how you have that that pharmaceutical tie-in and the whole conspiracy there. But he starts unraveling this conspiracy that involves people in his own chain of command, political figures, the pharmaceutical industry, the financial sector, and puts together his list and starts working his way up it one by one and putting them all on the ground.
Yeah, it's it is fun, and I've stayed on Coronado. I've eaten at the Hotel Del. Everything was very vivid in my mind. I thought, wow, I know this place well. And just for a little extra information, my concealed carry is a Glock 19 Gen 3. So, although I do understand Boozer's great affection for the 1911 chambered in 45 cal.
Exactly. There's something for everyone.
There is something for everyone, but there's some cool stuff in the story that people will love, because you get into some of the tactical stuff, and then there's these little jewels. Like on page 74, he's talking about his iPhone and how he's going to navigate off the grid, because all of us are so used to being connected. My whole thing is social media, and I need to get out information that who's going to be on the show, who's writing what for me, etc. But when you need to go off the grid, what do you do to do that? And here on page 74, you write about Reese, and he says, the joke in the teams was that smartphones were surveillance devices that also made phone calls. So he was figuring out, he left his smartphone behind, talking about getting a burner phone from Craigslist and everything you had to do to stay off the grid. And it's fun stuff, because I imagine that's kind of operational stuff. That's just things that ordinary stuff that SEALs do use.
Sure. And it's, it changes all the time, of course. So I had to reach out to some guys that really knew what they're doing in that space and pick their brains quite a bit. And I didn't give away all their secrets, but, I made, put enough in there to make it interesting without getting too technical.
Right. You put stuff in there, but nothing that should be redacted. This is stuff that the average person can know that you could find out easily if you Google around, but most of us don't really know what to Google for. But you give us snippets of stuff that really lend to the credibility of the whole entire story, which I absolutely loved. Really, really great stuff.
The Department of Defense Office of Pre-Publication and Review, even though it's a work of fiction, I just wanted to make sure that I was doing the right thing by my former security clearances. So it did go to the Department of Defense, and they took out a few sentences, as you probably noticed.
Yes, yes. And I understand that well. I have another friend, Matthew Bentley, that's been on the show that's a former Marine, and he writes for the same publishing house and has done really, really well. Same thing. You got to be careful. You want it to be exciting. You want it to be real, but you don't want to compromise a single mission that's out there or a single operator anywhere. You got to be very careful with that. If you're just joining the show, my guest is Jack Carr. He's a former Navy SEAL who led special ops teams on four continents as a team leader, platoon commander, troop commander, and task unit commander. As I said earlier, he's got a really extensive bio, which is fun for anybody that's in love with our military, like probably all my listeners are. Jack Carr is the author of a brand new book that comes out next Tuesday. Fabulous book. That's what we're talking about. The Terminal List. Once again, I've got a picture of it. I've got the title of it. You click on that after the show's done. Wait until the top of the hour. You want to hear everything he has to say and my next guest. But when you do, you're going to want a copy of this for yourself and for friends. I'm sure you've got at least a dozen friends that love these kind of books and you need to buy one. We set the stage for the book. The protagonist is Navy SEAL Commander James Reese. He's lost his team. He actually loses his beautiful wife and daughter. He's facing a cataclysmic health issue. And as you said, in other words, he has nothing to lose. Now, what's the Japanese term for that again, Jack?
Bushido.
So, and how do you spell that?
I'm gonna Google it. Bushido, I think.
Okay. Yeah, because I've heard of it before, and it is pretty darn interesting.
Well, it's like the Japanese version of a medieval knight's chivalry. It's a code of honor for the Japanese samurai.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, what I want to know as you started writing this, how in the world you retired or you left the teams in 2016.
Yep.
And then there you are and you're thinking, I want to write. What do you do? Did you have a basic idea? Did you approach other authors for advice?
Yeah. So I knew I wanted to be an author since I was a little kid. So at the same time I knew I wanted to be a Navy SEAL, I knew I wanted to write and I wanted to write fiction. And as I figured out there were different genres in fiction, this was the one that I just loved. And I loved reading books by Tom Clancy, by a guy named J.C. Pollock, by David Morrell, who created the character Rambo, by Nelson DeMille, who wrote a book, great book called The Charm School in the mid-80s. It was one of my favorites. And so I grew up reading this type of fiction, and I knew I wanted to do it someday. And that someday turned out to be right as I was getting out of the SEAL team. So, I had the idea for the story, and the title came to me right about the same time, and just started writing.
Wow. Now, how long did it take you to write your first draft?
It took about a year and a half. And that I would not have a book deal today if it hadn't been for Brad Thor. So a friend of mine put me in touch with Brad Thor, and he took the call, and it was before I just started the book. And he said, hey, I heard about some of the things you did in the SEAL teams, and I've never done this for anyone before, but if you write a book, I will send it to New York for you. I won't help you as you go along. I won't read any chapters. I can't guarantee that they'll open the package when it arrives in New York, and I can't guarantee they'll read it. Definitely can't guarantee that they'll like it, but as a thank you for your service, I will send it on for you. So I am forever grateful to Brad Thor for doing that, because he really did make this other dream in my life come true. So he sent it out, and sure enough, Emily Bessler at Simon & Schuster at Emily Bessler Books read it and loved it. Next thing you know, we're having coffee in New York, and next thing you know, we have a book deal.
It's pretty fantastic, but I can understand it because I've read the book. It's that good. Now here's something that's kind of interesting too. You've got little things here and there that it's pretty clear what your worldview is, and it's a pretty conservative, pro-America, pro-military, pro-Constitution type worldview. So, which I would say embodies almost all of us that love this genre of fiction, which is why it resonates with us so well. We like the good guys to win. We like all this stuff. But on page 88, you talk about Reese, and before he's getting ready to do what he needs to do, he goes to the weapons cache, and he could check out fully automatic machine guns and grenades from the same base upon which he was not allowed to carry his 9mm pistol. Policies created by bureaucrats in uniform essentially disarmed some of the most highly trained and competent warriors on Earth. It was only a matter of time until the enemy took advantage. And that's something that's always bugged me. And when I read that there, I was like, yeah, why is that? And I imagine you and other operators think that a lot, don't you, Jack Carr?
I would say that is a fair statement, especially in California, at least in Virginia. So the two places where you are stationed as a SEAL, for the most part, there's other places as well, but for the most part, San Diego and Virginia Beach. And in Virginia, much easier to get a concealed carry permit. Of course, you have to be careful about where you carry because there are still these gun-free zones like schools and things like that. But California, especially in San Diego, it is next to impossible to get a concealed carry permit. Yep. And I definitely went through the ringer, and the only reason I was able to get one was because Duncan Hunter intervened because of some things I did in Iraq, and I was able to get a California concealed carry, but hardly anyone can get one down there. Right. And I didn't know anybody else in the SEAL teams or in the military that had one. And once again, once you go on base and you can't have your 9mm pistol if you had a concealed carry, but you can go to an arms room and check out anything you possibly want. So it's very odd. Very odd.
Yeah. I think it's crazy. And especially in this day and age where we've got some bad actors and they're amongst us here in the United States. And some of them are citizens that have gone Looney Tunes. They're not the average Second Amendment gun toting American. There are others. And the fact that we can't get our best of the best armed and helping in our society. I'm one of these people that think, hey, yeah, let's let some of our former operators safeguard our schools in other areas. They'd be fantastic and they'd love to do it. It'd be another way they could serve their country.
Sense.
Yeah, that's go ahead.
That's too logical. That makes too much sense.
I know. Common sense conservatism. Something else you write in the book, as we're coming to the end of this. In the world of special operations, your reputation is your currency. And that's Reese thinking to himself. But he's having to deal with some people that are pretty much empty suits and worse. And I love that your reputation was your currency, because I think that should be true in every venue, avenue of life, but it's really that in the military. And I tell you what, you created a protagonist in James Reese in The Terminal List whose reputation is golden, and his currency is absolutely a jackpot right now. I think this book is really going to do well.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And the reputation being currency is, I think it's probably John Wooden where I got some of that.
I love John Wooden.
Yeah. I think he said something like, if you take care of your character, your reputation, if you see your character, your reputation will take care of itself, or something along those lines. But character and reputation are two separate things. Of course, people confuse them, but reputation is just what you're known as. So that's why I use that instead of character. But the entire book hopefully speaks to character.
Yes, it does. It really, really does. Man, John Wooden, another of my heroes. You are absolutely a kindred spirit, Jack Carr.
We got to go shooting together sometime.
We ought to go shooting together. Hey, everybody, I've told you several times, you got to get The Terminal List. Click on the links on the show. Click on the picture. Jack Carr, thanks for making the time to be on the show. I just know The Terminal List will be a huge bestseller, and I can't wait to have you on with your next book.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Okay, take care.
You too.
You're listening to the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. I'll be back on the other side of the break with author of Movie Nights with the Reagans, Mark Weinberg.
You're on the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
Let's talk tech. Tech news discussions from the people in the industry right here in Pittsburgh. Online, gadgets, startups, and more. Check it out at awesomecast.net.
AwesomeCast. It's all about tech, and it's all about gadgets. It's AwesomeCast, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
This is Mike from the Wrestling Mayhem Show, the show where we get fans and people in the wrestling industry together to talk about pro wrestling, WWE, NXT, WrestleMania, all kinds of fun. It's a podcast party. Check it out, Wrestling Mayhem Show, right here on the 405 Media.
Listen to the Wrestling Mayhem Show, now 7 nights a week, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, right here on the 405media.com.
The 405.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
405.
The Tammy Jackson Show is brought to you by Rent-A-Computer. An agent from rentacomputer.com can save your company time and money on your next short-term need for a computer, audiovisual, or office equipment rental. Rentacomputer.com delivers the rental hardware your event needs to your office, trade show booth, or event venue location anywhere in the United States or Canada. Their offerings include Apple iPads, iPhones, Microsoft Surface tablets, and even copiers. So if you're planning your next corporate event, remember, rentacomputer.com provides a superior turnkey event rental service with only one point of contact for clients, both large and small. Visit rentacomputer.com or call them at 800-736-8772. That's rentacomputer.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show. Welcome back, everybody. This is Tammy Jackson. I'm a little over halfway through the show here on the 405, and now I am joined by my next guest, Mark Weinberg. Mark Weinberg is a former speechwriter and advisor to President Ronald Reagan. He served on the 1980 Reagan campaign traveling staff all 8 years in the Reagan White House and 2 years thereafter as Reagan's spokesman in his post-presidency office in Los Angeles. Mark is an experienced executive communications consultant who has held senior management positions at Fortune 500 corporations and the federal government. He lives in New Jersey with his wife and two children. Mark Weinberg, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I was thrilled to hear about you and your book, thrilled to receive my copy of your wonderful new book, debuting today, which is fantastic, Movie Nights with the Reagans, and a memoir. Now, per usual, everybody listening, I have the book The Amazon page linked to both the title and the picture on the show page. So once the show is over, you want to hear everything Mark has to say. But when the show's over at the top of the hour, head to the show page, click on those links, and buy copies of this wonderful book. Mark Weinberg, there are many reasons why I wanted to read this book and talk with you. And at the top of the list is my admiration for Ronald Reagan. I began listening to him as a 10-year-old, believe it or not. I accidentally found him on my radio. I thought he was funny and made sense. And my parents caught me listening to him and asked, "Who are you listening to, Tammy, on a Saturday in your bedroom?" I said, "A really funny guy. You guys would like him. His name is Ronald Reagan." Then as I hit Oregon State University, I was a young Republican on campus, and I campaigned for Ronald Reagan, and my first vote for president ever was for Ronald Reagan in 1980. So I just, as I heard about this, I thought, oh my goodness, I've got to read this book. And you were a part of his team from the very beginning in that 1980 Reagan presidential campaign. What was that like, Mark Weinberg?
It was a wonderful experience. And I look back on it, some days it seems like it was yesterday, some days it seems like it was a million years ago. It was just a wonderful experience, and I recalled it fondly as I was writing Movie Nights and how it all began and what it all led to.
Wow, wow. You end the intro of the book, Movie Nights with the Reagans, a memoir, with a disclaimer of sorts. You write, "Let me be clear at the outset. I am a proudly biased fan of President and Mrs. Reagan. I feel incredibly honored to have had the rare opportunity to work for them, travel with them, and share some of their deeply treasured time at Camp David with them." Mark, that just made me smile. One cannot read this book and the many memories you detail and not feel the great admiration and fondness that you felt for Ronald and Nancy Reagan.
Well, that's true. You're absolutely right, and I wanted to be honest with readers at the very beginning of what the book was and what the book wasn't. And the reason I wrote the book was because I wanted to present a side of the Reagans that had never been seen before. There have never been any books written about what it was like spending weekends with them at Camp David watching movies. And I wanted to share my story. It's a story that Mrs. Reagan helped me write. She granted me what I believe is the last interview before she passed away, and we talked about weekends at Camp David and movies, and she shared some very interesting feelings with me, and I wanted to share those with people as well.
It reminds me that when I lost my mom, and she died at a relatively young age of 53. She'd been 53 for 10 days in a rare cancer. But afterwards, some of the best times I had were talking with mutual acquaintances and people that knew Mom, some well, some not so well, with them sharing stories of how Mom had impacted them, stories of her life. And I loved that. That was like gold to me. So as I thought of you sitting down with Nancy, she greeted you at the door, even though she couldn't stand up at the time. I believe that was in 2015.
That's right.
My thought was, I bet for her that it was bittersweet in a way, but it was something she got to talk about her beloved husband. And she got to do that with somebody else that admired him and a friend, and that was you. So I think that your book is not only a gift to the world, I think that you sharing that time with her was a gift to her.
Well, it was really a gift to me. And I understand why you say that. But when I told her that I was writing a book about our weekends at Camp David, she smiled and said, "I know you are. It's such a special time." It was so clear to me that she wanted this story told. And on the back of the book is a letter, a portion of a letter that she sent to me It says, Mark, I am delighted to hear you are writing a book about Camp David. There are a lot of wonderful stories to be told, and just thinking about those days brings back such happy memories fondly, Nancy. This is a book, my only regret about this book, I had so much fun writing it and reliving those memories and seeing those movies all over again with the Reagans in my mind at least, and the one regret is that I couldn't deliver a copy to her because I know she was interested in it and would have wanted to read it, and just like you said, take her back to a time with her husband.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Well, you include stories that illustrate Ronald Reagan's kindness and his thoughtful nature. For instance, on page 4 of Movie Nights with the Reagans, a memoir, you write, "The president was sometimes criticized for leaving the Oval Office at 5 o'clock every day, contributing to the false impression among some in the pundit class that he was old and lazy. Actually, it was an intentional practice. He left then because he knew that if he was in the office, the staff would stay as long as he did. He wanted them to go home at reasonable hours and be with their families." I thought, that's fantastic. That sounds like the man I thought he was.
You would not have been disappointed. And as you go through Movie Nights, you will read the anecdotes. One after another confirms what you just said about the kind of person he was. He, one of the scenes I describe in Movie Nights is being in the Oval Office on a Saturday morning when the president did his radio address to the nation. And I point out that that is the only time that Ronald Reagan did not wear a suit or a tie in the Oval Office and a jacket. And you know why he did that? Because he told us, he said, you know, if I dress up on Saturday for the radio speech, then all the people who have to work on it have to dress up too. And I didn't want to have them have to do that. And there are multiple examples throughout this book of how he thought of other people first.
Wow, wow. I also learned a little tidbit in the book that I've never known. You mentioned that the White House operators were the best in the world, that they could find anyone, anywhere, anytime. And that made me laugh because you had to find somebody and you learned how good they really are.
Well, that was the joke, that if you were alive, they could find you. And even if you weren't, they probably could. That's true. That's true. You know, speaking of the White House operators, I will never forget. I tell this story in the book of President Reagan calling me one day to talk about a decision that Donald Reagan had made, and the White House operators had a way of just making every call sound important, and it just as if it wasn't important enough. But they were spectacular. They were fabulous. They were so pleased to serve, and many of them had been there through a number of administrations.
Wow! Wow! Yeah, you make the funny comment that you can allow the operators to announce you rather than announcing yourself, and that you rarely made use of that unless you wanted to impress one of your friends. I thought that was cute.
That's right. You know, one of the things that I do in Movie Nights is kind of take readers behind the scenes at Camp David mostly, but at the White House too. And what you're referring to there is sometimes if I needed to locate a reporter, I would ask the White House operator to help me find him or her, and they said to me, "Sir, will you take the ring?" And I had no idea what that meant. That's White House lingo. And what it meant was, do you want me to dial the number once we find it and just turn the call over to you and you can announce yourself, or do you want me to announce, "This is the White House, I have Mr. So-and-so calling for you"? and those were the little idiosyncrasies about life at Camp David, life at the White House, life as a former president that weren't revealed before that I thought would be fun to share with people.
Oh, it's wonderful. All these little snippets, these little vignettes are terrific. Now, when the book, each chapter highlights the viewing of a movie at Camp David, and there are a lot of movies. I'll mention more of them at towards the end, but you would get to Camp David, and you stayed in a cabin named Sycamore, I believe. Would you just describe the ritual of movie nights at Camp David?
The ritual was that on Friday or Saturday nights at at 7:45, the small, very small number of staff who were at Camp David with the Reagans would gather in front of their residence, which is called Aspen Lodge, and it's a modest ranch story home, a nice home, house, on the grounds of Camp David, and you'd stand in front of the door, and at 7:45, the door would open, and President Reagan would welcome everybody, and he would open the door himself, and he would bring you in, and the group would gather in front of the fireplace where Mrs. Reagan was usually waiting, who would express how happy she was to see everybody. There would be some brief remarks about the movie we were going to see, or just some idle chatter, and then people would take their seats. And I describe in here for the first time how everybody sat. There was a regular seating order, and how the movies unfolded and what the refreshments were. And what I tried to do is to bring the reader into the living room of Aspen Lodge to watch the movies with them.
And you did a great job at it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I loved it. You started out with 9 to 5. That was the first one. And there were a couple issues with 9 to 5. They generally liked the movie, but understandably, a number of the military personnel were not too fond of Hanoi Jane being a star in the movie, and that also troubled Reagan a little bit. And there was the infamous smoking pot scene, which I always thought was a little weird myself. And both Ronald and Nancy were not pleased with that scene.
They sure weren't, and it could have been one of their favorite movies, and there are several in the book that I think were their favorite movies that they enjoyed a lot. They were bothered by that, and they both felt that it was unnecessary, that it glamorized drugs. President Reagan said, well, golly, if they had, you know, been drinking or something, that might have been okay. But remember, drugs were illegal, and it glamorized it, and he didn't like that. He didn't think it was funny. Mrs. Reagan was annoyed by it and later criticized it in a speech. And I think it kind of ruined the movie for the Reagans.
Yeah, and I understood that, too. And I thought, well, and it certainly gave some impetus for Nancy Reagan's campaign to just say no, definitely. So chapter 2 of Movie Nights with the Reagans, a memoir, and of course I'm speaking with Mark Weinberg. It's about Oh God, Book 2, and you talk at length about Ronald Reagan's close friendship with George Burns, and it seems I caught the notion that George might have been the one who taught Reagan originally to use humor in his presentation and speeches.
He did. He was a big influence on him, and they enjoyed the movie. George Burns and Ronald Reagan, and not many people know this, kept in touch for many, many years after the Hollywood years. There would be telegrams and letters. He was a true friend. In fact, I asked Mrs. Reagan, we talked about George Burns in that final interview, and she said, well, the thing about George was he was just down to earth and funny and pleasant, a regular guy, not full of himself or full of Hollywood. And I said, well, that sounds like someone else we know. And she laughed. And you're right, that George had a way about him that I think made him a natural friend of Ronald Reagan's.
My goodness. And you had little quips that Reagan is famous for that display his humor. He seemed to be a natural at self-deprecating humor, including the quip I mentioned before we came on air during one of his speeches or something. He poked fun at his own age, and he said, I never drink coffee at lunch. I find it keeps me awake in the afternoon. I thought that was just priceless. You also write throughout the book about the Reagans' love of Camp David, and you write on page 28, President Reagan had come to love Camp David for many different reasons. It was not his nature to be cooped up all day inside. He much preferred the outdoors, such as the horseback and jeep rides he took at the California ranch. So once again, a side of Reagan that not everybody saw.
No, and you're absolutely right. We had seen, we all saw him at the White House, and the country saw him at the ranch, but they didn't see him at Camp David. They would get on that helicopter on Friday, and we'd go up there, and they'd be out of sight. And one of the things I wanted to do in movie nights was show that side of them, was to paint that picture, was to bring that private time at Camp David out in the open and let people know what they were really like when it was just them with no cameras and no functions and no press, and just when they were Nancy and Ronald Reagan. And it was, and one, the reason I wanted to do that was because I knew how much it meant to them, and I thought it was just a very interesting look at them that hadn't been provided before. They loved it up there because it was private, it was informal, it was relaxed, and they could just be people again.
Yes. Something else, Mark Weinberg, that you make very clear in the book, contrary to what so many pundits and gossip rags of the day used to say or write, you found Nancy Reagan to be warm and gracious. Now, I was happy to learn that. I always thought it must be true, but I have to tell you, there were a time or two during the Reagan years when people would be saying something to me, they were probably a little more liberal and critical, but they'd say something to the effect that I hear Nancy Reagan is very cold and impersonal. And I would always respond that I did not know her personally, but what I did know was that she loved and supported her husband, and who could ask more than that from a first lady? But you show a very gracious side of her in this book, and that was fun to learn.
She was certainly a very loyal and protective wife, and she had to be because President Reagan didn't always protect himself as well as he might have. But that what you described before was a caricature of her that some in the not-so-favorable media created, and people bought into it, and it just wasn't true. And this book, Movie Nights, is filled with examples, specific examples, of her kindness and warmth and decency and just really loving nature. And I have to tell you that you will find, as you take this journey to Camp David and watch the movies and sit with the Reagans, you'll feel her warmth. You'll feel her welcoming spirit, and the fact that this is somebody who you could sit and laugh with and gossip with and talk with for hours.
Wow. Yes, I love that. Now, I found the chapter on Golden Pond was interesting. There were obviously some great parallels between the movie characters and the Reagans and their outspoken daughter, Patty. And once again, there's Jane Fonda in the movie, and the president was troubled by Fonda and Tom Hayden's friendship with Patty. Would you explain a little bit why that was?
Well, the president and Mrs. Reagan were both very loving, caring, and devoted parents. And they knew that their being in public life posed special challenges for their children, who just really wanted to be children growing up. But when your father is the president and your mother's the first lady or governor and so forth, it makes it a little harder. And President Reagan was concerned that Jane Fonda might be creating a friendship with Patty so that she could use her in some way in her own political agenda, and that disturbed him. He never wanted his children to be used. He was fiercely protective of them.
Yes. Wow. You cover so many movies in this book. Of course, there's a movie per chapter, and some of these movies in the book, Movie Nights with the Reagans, a memoir, some of the movies include Raiders of the Lost Ark, E.T., Curse of the Pink Panther, Bedtime for Bonzo, Back to the Future, Top Gun, The Untouchables, and there's a lot more. But one memorable film that you end with was Hellcats of the Navy, and both Ronald and Nancy starred in that movie. You write on page 223, when we walked into Aspen, the president, wearing a mischievous look, greeted us with one of his trademark phrases, telling us we were in for a treat, or at least he hoped so. We knew what that meant. Reagan had used that line before to let us know we were about to watch one of his own movies. And sure enough, the feature that night was Hellcats of the Navy, starring Ronald Reagan and Nancy Davis. And it was the last movie either of them had made. I just thought that was so fascinating. Now I want to go watch that movie after reading this.
You would enjoy it. And in researching this book, I was reminded that it was the last one that they had made, and it was also the only one they made together.
Yes. Wow. It's so fascinating. And after each of these movies, you
talk about the fact that there was usually a gathering at the back of the room and lots of questions and discussions about the movies, and even more so if it was one of Ronald Reagan's movies, or like this one, Hellcats of the Navy, with both of them in it.
That's right. And one of the fun parts of writing this book and recalling those conversations was the gleam in their eye when he would tell us stories from the set of Newt Rockne All-American, or stories from the set of Bedtime for Bonzo, or stories from the set of Hellcats of the Navy. And it was really fun, just true fun, to watch the two of them remember Hellcats together, which I had not seen before, and I don't think many people had, to see the two of them discuss it. And then in that final interview, we discussed Hellcats of the Navy again and her fond memories of that. It was clear to me, and one of the things I wanted to convey in this book is how important movies were to the Reagans as people, because it's where they met each other. It's where their careers began. It's where they developed some of the skills that made them so successful on the national stage. And it was obvious when they talked about Hellcats of the Navy that they had such a fondness for the movie business, which is why I think President Reagan would be so troubled of the direction in which it's gone lately.
Yeah, I think so as well, because they held some pretty wholesome ideals. But you did mention in the book quite a bit that people liked dealing with Ronald Reagan when he had to give televised addresses, etc., that he was a pro, he knew what to do, he knew about lighting, he knew about all of that. So there were some great skills that he did learn through that business and Mrs. Reagan that helped him. Well, the time has gone so quickly. I want, once again, to tell everybody, you've got to click on the links on the show page. You need to get Mark Weinberg's book, Movie Nights with the Reagans, a memoir. Mark, in this book, you've given us, it's not just a memoir, it's a warm portrait of a beloved president and his adoring wife. This book is a real gem, and I want to thank you for writing it. And
And
I want to thank you for taking the time to be on the show and talk about it.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and as you say, for anybody who is a fan of the Reagans, or a fan of the movies, or a fan of the 80s, or even just interested in them, I think this book will be a very fun read for them.
It is. It's a wonderful read. I wish you great success with the book.
Thank
it's
you.
Been fun getting to know you.
It's been my pleasure to talk to you, and to have the honor to speak to your audience.
Very good. Take care.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 will be back next week with more great guests. Until then, this is Tammy Jackson reminding you to wake up and don't be silent. Let your voice be heard, because we still have a country to save.
I cut my teeth on the back of an old church pew. I learned to walk in the ways of light and truth, and I was told not to speak till I was spoken to. I heard it preached what I should and I should not do, and the choir sang. Tried to be a good boy, ain't a boy no more. I've seen some things that a man just can't ignore, and this world's gonna see what I'm standing for. I've kept my peace, but I can't hold my tongue anymore. You can't buy my silence, you can't steal my voice, you can't. Down, tell me to shut my mouth, but there's a time to speak, and the time is now. Oh, 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 oh.